Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, Sweden, safe haven for many refugees from Iraq. Culture, exploring its relevance for us as Catholics today.
But first, our top news story from the Vatican was the meeting between Pope Benedict XVI and King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, which was the first audience given by a pope at the Vatican with a Saudi monarch. Pope Benedict warmly greeted the king, whose country is home to nearly a million Catholics, clasping both his hands before heading into the 30-minute audience held in the pope's private library. Behind these closed doors, the Holy Father and Saudi monarch touched on a number of subjects close to both their hearts. Notably, they confirmed they would engage in both intercultural and interreligious dialogue. A statement issued by the Holy See said this dialogue would be directed to the peaceful and profitable cohabitation between peoples and the value of the collaboration between Christians, Muslim and Jews for the promotion of peace, of justice and of the spiritual and moral values, especially to support the family. Another theme of these discussions was the situation in the Middle East. In this, both the Pope and King Abdullah agreed on the importance of finding the right solution to the conflicts that torment the region, especially with regard to the situation with the Israelis and Palestinians. Bishop Paul Hinder and Apostolic Vicar of Arabia spoke about what steps forward he hoped this meeting could bring.
Every meeting of this kind should contribute to more peace in general in the world, and also to a better understanding, mutual understanding between the different religions. And then, of course, as the bishop of the area, I am interested on a step forward regarding more religious freedom, or let's say freedom of worship.
Following the audience, both men exchanged gifts. King Abdullah presented Pope Benedict with a traditional Middle Eastern present, a gold sword, as well as a gold and silver statue of a palm tree and a man riding a camel. The 84-year-old king has already been to London and Geneva, and following this Italian leg of his European tour, he will travel on to Germany and Turkey. For more analysis on this historical meeting, tune into our feature programme at the same time tomorrow. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Well, thanks so much for joining me once again as I take you with me to a northern nation, a place currently a haven for many Iraqi refugees fleeing their homeland. Just to give you an idea of the figures regarding the people we're speaking about, according to the United Nations body which deals with refugees, UNHCR, the numbers of uprooted refugees from Iraq are estimated at 4.5 million. Well, for the record, 2 million more are currently internally displaced. What's special about this story and this northern nation I'll be taking to you in a moment is that it's the only place in Europe where an open-door policy concerning this particular group of refugees has been adopted. That's how I understood this story, as my colleague Susie Hodges mentioned it to me. But if you're interested in the full story, do stay tuned as we go over to Susie and indeed her guests, among them George Joseph, who works with refugees at Caritas Sweden, and to Hassan, one of the many Iraqi refugees who came to Sweden over the past couple of years.
It's located a long way from the Middle East, but Sweden has become the country of choice for many Iraqis trying to reach Europe. Even before the US-led invasion of Iraq in 2003, Sweden had a large Iraqi expatriate community and a tradition of taking in refugees. It also has a generous welfare system, and its people are sympathetic to the plight of the Iraqis forced to flee the sectarian violence that is tearing their country apart. George Joseph works with refugees at Caritas Sweden, and he says because of Sweden's hospitable stance, more and more Iraqis are making their way there.
Sweden had a long tradition of giving sanctuary to the asylum seekers and the people fleeing from violence and persecution. And the issue of Iraqis, we have had a rather big community of Iraqis, especially the Chaldean Christians and the Syrian Christians in Sweden last 20 years or so. So that's one of the reasons why many of the Iraqis trying to reach Sweden, because there is also a rumor, especially when I was visiting in Syria, that I recognize they all think Sweden is the only country which gave them permit or allowed them to come in Europe. So that's also a reason why very many Iraqis trying to reach Sweden.
Among the many Iraqi refugees who have come to Sweden over the past couple of years is Hussein Atso, a 24-year-old student from Baghdad. He has nothing but praise for the welcome he has received from his host country.
It was, indescribable the way they treated us over here. It was so good, so humanitarian. They make you feel that you're human again. That's how it was for me and for pretty much everybody I talk with about this. They all agree with me. It's just amazing. They take care of you. You don't feel threatened. You don't feel humiliated. You don't feel unwanted. They take care of pretty much everything for you. Everybody gets health attention, everybody gets an education, everybody gets a place to live. It's so good.
But to go back a bit in time, I asked Hussein what events or threats prompted him to leave his home country.
The main reason I left Iraq, just like any other Christians, is the situation in Iraq, the safety issue. Nobody is safe, even in his house. We started to have these problems. You are the unbelievers. You're all going to hell. This is the holy land. You can't stay here anymore. Some people just show it right in your face. They tell you how they feel about you.
Were you actually specifically threatened, though?
Yes, absolutely. Because it happens an incident that U.S. Army forces came to our neighborhood, and they needed somebody to speak English so they can help them with translating with somebody else in the street who needed help. So since I speak English, I just offered help. And I spoke to them. And after this, I had lots of phone calls or people in the street. We'll kill you. We'll kill your family. You're helping the unbelievers and so, all these kind of threats.
And those threats Hussein and his family received were not an isolated case. He says many other of his Christian compatriots now living in Sweden have a similar story to tell.
In my neighborhood, before I leave Iraq, 4 churches had been blown up. Many of Iraqi families have been forced to leave their homes because they were Christian from many neighborhoods in Baghdad alone.
After receiving those death threats, Hussein and his family fled their homeland. As he goes on to explain, Hussein had no firm or prior aim of going to Sweden when he left Iraq, but was encouraged there by smugglers.
When you try to run away for your life and you're in that much danger, you don't really think which country. You don't have this luxury of choosing where do you want to go. The first place that it's possible for us to go safe, we just go. And for me, it happened to be Sweden.
How easy was it for you to reach Sweden, and how did you make that long journey there?
Just like all other Iraqis, through smugglers, they just bring you here and, charge a lot of money for it.
How much money did they charge you and your family?
It's different for me and my brothers, but for me as a person, it costs me about $14,000.
But when it comes to the legal side, how easy is it for the Iraqi refugees arriving in Sweden to be granted a residence permit? Joseph says, although more generous than other European countries, not all the Iraqi refugees are granted permission to stay there.
75% are being given permit to stay, either protection reasons or humanitarian considerations.
What happens to the remaining 25%, those whose application is refused?
Yeah, they will be given a negative decision, and they are expected to leave the country voluntarily because post-deportation is not possible today. And that's one other problem. Most of them will appeal, but the problem is that the Swedish appeal court has made a guideline decisions where they claim there are no armed conflict going on in Iraq according to the legal definition, which means that the immigration board decisions in the future will be based on this guideline decision unless the Iraqi asylum seekers can prove they are themselves personally targeted. It will be difficult for them to get a permit to stay. So those 25% who are rejected, they will be forced to leave the country or they will be living in a legal limbo.
And are there many of these people living in a legal limbo, living illegally in Sweden?
Yes, they are. What they normally do is, since the police cannot deport them, so they will allow to stay, but they will not give them any support in order to force them to leave by themselves. So the people just leave without any support of the society. So normally they turn to the churches for help.
Joseph says Caritas and other church and faith-based organizations are lobbying the Stockholm government to be less restrictive.
Yeah, we are trying to mobilize the whole Catholic Church in Sweden and especially the parishes and also other churches to do the best we can to support and help these people. Meanwhile, we will try to do everything possible politically to try to influence and to change the decision or the attitude of the government regarding that.
But despite these restrictions, Sweden still shines out as a beacon of hope to the thousands of Iraqi refugees fleeing their homeland and heading north. And this is backed up by official figures for 2006 that show that nearly half of all Iraqis who came to Europe ended up in Sweden. But how does Hussein feel about the fact that, with the exception of Sweden, most other European countries have a virtual closed-door policy towards the Iraqi refugees?
I feel sorry for the Iraqi people, because Iraqi people were victims. I mean, if you can't live in your own country and there's no other country willing to take you, it's bad, I think.
So do you feel angry about it?
I feel a bit angry from countries that have no good excuse not to help Iraqis. They should help more with immigration, but I mean, I understand it's not as easy, but at least they can do is try to find a solution with other countries to open their doors to Iraqis. Iraqis are not being helped as much as they should.
So when it comes to his country's future, does Hussein foresee himself returning there anytime soon?
I don't think anytime soon I'll be returning to my homeland, because it's not like a country that only needs reconstruction or need some rebuilding or some other things that time can solve it. The problem in Iraq right now is a mental problem, the way people think, the way extremists think.
So when it comes to your feelings, when you look at the situation in your homeland, how do you feel? I mean, what emotions do you feel?
I feel sad, really sad.
Well, thanks there to Susie Hodges and to her guests on this programme. George Joseph, who works with refugees at Caritas Sweden, and to Hassan, one of the many Iraqi refugees who came to Sweden over the past couple of years. Meanwhile, it's time to join someone who's changed jobs yet again. He's familiar to our regular listeners, and not so long ago he was working as an official at the Pontifical Council for Culture, and is now coordinator for Catholic contribution to Liverpool's year as the 2008 European Capital of Culture. Well, culture seems to be at the heart of his life then. That's why I thought I'd ask him what kind of a place culture has or should have for us as Catholics in today's society. You may have guessed, he's Monsignor Peter Fleetwood. So if you're at all curious, listen to what he told me. Have we forgotten about culture in today's society, and what is the importance of it for us in particular as Catholics?
Outside the Catholic Church, we most certainly have not forgotten about culture. I live now in the city. I've gone back to the city of my birth because the Archbishop said, we need you here for the year when Liverpool is going to be the European Capital of Culture. Many people around England just laugh when you speak of Liverpool as a city of culture, but I think that the nature of people's understanding of culture has developed over the years. Once upon a time, it was the education for the privileged, and it was always classical culture, beginning with art and philosophy from Greece and Rome, and then a broad awareness of art and thought, the history of thought, through the centuries.
Influenced by the monastic tradition?
Most likely, yeah, that they had the great libraries, but the libraries were always first and foremost places where the classical works were kept and consulted. I've just come from an amazing library. I lived 4.5 years in St. Gallen in Switzerland, and just over the road from our office was the old abbey. The church is still the cathedral church, but next to it is the Stiftsbibliothek, the abbey library, and there are more Irish manuscripts there than in the whole of Ireland, in ancient terms anyway, because the monks who originally came were Irish and British. Their own language is there in the form of notes. It's a remarkable library. So it was from the days when there only were classical books, because printing hadn't been invented in the early stages of that library, obviously. But then things have broadened out, and people think of culture now as the characteristics of a particular group. It used to be ethnic groups, and anthropologists introduced that notion of culture as the behaviour and ritual and all sorts belonging to a particular tribe or ethnic group. And then it's become the culture of groups in society, youth culture or pop culture. I think they have a lot that's questionable, these forms of culture, but we ignore them at our risk because I've always been under the impression that Jesus meant what he said when he said, go and teach all nations. I take that to mean all people. And if we exclude certain groups of people by the way we talk or our failure to understand what they're talking about, we're not doing our job. And that's where I see the need for people in the church who have the time and the expertise to tune in to different ways of seeing the world in which we live, in order to be able to give the message to them, also in order to hear what they're saying, because it has to be a two-way process. And I was very glad to have the privilege, quite an unexpected privilege, of working 7.5 years in the Vatican's Office for Culture, where I learnt a lot about the importance of recognising how people speak, think, act, even within the Catholic world.
Just to take an example, sacred art is interesting to a lot of people who are not Catholic. So we tend to not take an interest in our own art, as it were, and then people who are maybe might be atheist or whatever take an interest in sacred art. I find it very strange at times.
Pope John Paul II wrote a letter to artists, which has a curious pair of paragraphs in it. It's how the church needs artists and how artists need the church.
And which he got inspiration from Paul VI, when he spoke to artists in the Sistine Chapel.
Yes, yes, same idea, exactly the same idea. I think the point is really that even though an artist may herself or himself not be convinced by the Christianity, that doesn't make it impossible for them to create something that means a lot to Christians. I've been told that Gabriel Fauré was not a practicing Christian,
but he's
written, yes, he's written one of the most beautiful Requiem Masses ever written. Well, I hope they play the In Paradisum when they send me off. It's a beautiful piece of music. But it was not written out of personal conviction, but it was written by somebody with the sensitivity to understand what the sacred texts of the funeral liturgy mean to people. And his attempt is to take us to another level of experience, joy and understanding. And it works. And I think many pictorial artists and sculptors are in the same boat. They choose a well-known theme from the scriptures or from the history of religion. And the fact that they believe or that they don't believe has very little to do with the end result. And I think the fact that that was recognised by Pope Paul VI and then by Pope John Paul II is a sign of the Church's ability to accept beauty wherever it comes from. And the bold step was to suggest that artists need the Church. I don't just mean for money, for commissions, but also the wisdom and the beauty that is inside Christian history is available to them too.
So spirituality within culture, yeah. In a sense,
yeah? Yeah. Christianity has had a phenomenal effect on the structure of life in Europe and European culture since the Middle Ages, if not before, particularly since the Middle Ages. I've seen towns in England where it's absolutely clear when you drive into a valley that what's at the bottom near where the road crosses the river is a former monastery, and there are lots of houses around the monastery. And when the monasteries were sacked in the 16th century, the medical service and any education that there was and a lot much of the social services disappeared because that was part of the structure of the monastic life. They weren't concentrated on themselves. Their job was to pray and to make time sacred. But it overflowed into the local community. They gave some of them jobs and they looked after them in different ways. It wasn't all as bad as it's made to seem sometimes. So Christianity was making a little imprint on local societies. I think also when it comes to values, it's very important to allow Christianity to have a voice in the way we formulate laws and the way we educate people. I don't say that Christianity should be the only voice, but I think that it's true that Christianity in its best form is very good for people. It's very good for maintaining the doctrine that life is sacred in all its forms, for example, and it's also very good in pointing out that amongst the sins crying to heaven for vengeance are things like not paying the labourer a just wage. I don't think Christianity has a monopoly on good insights, but there is such a huge body of wisdom and moral quality there to be shared with the world. And I'm only hopeful that politicians and people of influence will never completely shut the door on the dialogue with Christianity and with the other religions indeed, because we have a lot to contribute to the formation of a really human culture. People who find religion a difficult thing very often repeat what Feuerbach, the German philosopher who inspired Marx, incidentally, on what he had to say on religion. They agree with Feuerbach that there's not enough room in the world for both God and humanity. It's either one or the other, and they feel that to exalt God is to demean human beings and vice versa. That's a very sad and limited view of the universe. I think when religion is doing its thing properly, it actually improves a lot of humanity and has quite an influence on culture. Then again, I think the culture in which we live has a lot to contribute sometimes to the way we operate as a church. I'm delighted that it must have begun really with the Enlightenment. Since the Enlightenment, the rights of human beings have been stressed, quite rightly. Sometimes it goes to excess and people think only of their rights. But it's good that a religion which has been criticised for focusing on people's duties is also living and working in a world where people's rights are, quite rightly, and thank God, stressed much more nowadays. I think we have to jump on that bus and stay on it, and never fall behind. Again, Catholic social teaching says many of those things as well. I'm just glad and proud that we have a contribution to make. But I just repeat once more, I think we have a lot to learn as well from contemporary culture, the way people see themselves and the way people see society.
And from other religions.
Yes, naturally. Just historically, we would have had no Thomas Aquinas or Albert the Great without the work done by Arab scholars on Aristotle. When there was a great dark age in Europe and much of classical culture was unknown outside the monasteries, the Arabs kept philosophical debate alive. And it was at the time, shortly after the birth of Islam, that this very, very highly developed culture was busy in southern Europe. I know Spaniards feel very cagey if you say things like that, because much of their cultural world was in southern Spain. But it would be foolish to say that there'd been no input from Islam into European culture. There's been a lot. And that was a long, long time ago, before Islam became an issue the way in which it is now.
We, as a Catholic radio station, should promote culture. How do you think we should go about doing that?
There's obvious ways, like concerts and I think maybe programmes about art, sacred art. There's been some very good ones on this very radio station, I remember. I think maybe more debates, where you get a few people in to discuss a topic of importance and how, for example, Christianity can have something to say on issues of the day. Culture isn't simply art and music and dance. All those things can be covered and should be covered, but culture is also the way people think, the way they react to the problems of life. One of the major documents of the Second Vatican Council, Gaudium et Spes, Luctus et Angor, anguish and grief of all men are the hopes, the fears, the anguish and grief of all Christians, meaning that we should never ignore any human experience. Quite the contrary, our concern with people's experience should be at the centre of our ministry to the world in which we live. And therefore, whatever in our culture today, whether we're proud of it or afraid of it, whatever speaks to modern people, and I would say, for reasons I would be prepared to explain on another day, particularly what affects younger people and gives them problems with the way older people behave in the world, I think if we don't listen to that, we're not doing our job. And what the radio here could do would be to open discussions on issues that apparently have nothing to do with religion, but in reality are people's questions about religion. If we ignore people's questions about religion, we're not talking to them. And once we stop talking, we're not doing what Jesus asked us to do, which was to preach to all nations, to share the gospel, the good news, and to remind people, as he did, that the kingdom of God is amongst us. It's not very far, as far as we'd like to think. We can't hide, but we do bury our heads in the sand sometimes. And I think the radio could be a great weapon in the fight against burying our heads in the sand. And there's so much here in Rome. You've got fantastic access to people passing through or some of the great folks who live here who could contribute an awful lot to that kind of thing. But as I say, debates are a thing I think are particularly useful, particularly for people sitting at home who can't read books or haven't got the books, haven't got the money. If there was stuff explained in terms of a discussion in accessible language, I think they'd be delighted and they'd be very grateful. And it would help avoid some of the extremes that we're having to face in the parishes. I've got people quoting documents to me that they don't understand. And it's very hard work to react charitably and say, yes, but the document also says other things. And there are, in fact, other documents that say more things. I haven't got the time, although I have the desire, to help them understand the context of much of what is said by the Catholic Church. And the little knowledge really is a dangerous thing. So I think the more knowledge, in that sense, that Vatican Radio can offer, the greater a service it will be offering to the whole Catholic Church, not to specialists, but to quite ordinary people who really do need encouragement and education.
So we should go beyond just doing actuality on Vatican Radio?
Yeah, I think if it can be done, some retreat from the immediate concerns of the present moment into mature thought about issues that don't go away, but maybe not are the issue of today or this moment. It's like educating your children. You don't just tell them how to respond to crises. You actually want them to be creative and to put something into life. But they can't do that unless they've been formed. And forming is much more than filling them with information. It's helping them to grow in the way they understand and respond. And I think that can be done for all Catholics. And it would be terrible if simply you hear facts. What's happening? It's gossip in the end, unless there's some understanding of it and appreciation of it. And I think you really need to help people appreciate what's happening in the Church, appreciate what the Church says, appreciate the Pope, appreciate the work being done by religious against AIDS in Africa, and why the Church is committed to things like that, the privileged place we give to the poor and the sick in places like Lourdes and in the collections we have for the missions. All those things, why do we do it? And the more you're doing that, you're actually translating the gospel into a very useful language.
Into culture.
Well, yeah, because all of those things we do as a contribution to culture, and yet so often we rely on the local cultures too. They are the place we work. They're our ambiente, they're our atmosphere. The air we breathe is the culture we live in.
Our thanks there go to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, who's currently a coordinator for Catholic contribution to Liverpool's year as the 2008 European Capital of Culture. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org.
You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.